seatbelts. It's time for the Diana Voss Show, where the truth hurts. Boston native, American patriot, political activist, and MAGA fanatic. With boots on the ground, she's the talk of the town. Never gives in, she'll never back down. And now, here's your host, Diana the Voss.
And this is the guest host, Hal Shurtleff-Hilligan for Diana Plus, who's at the Trump rally. And I don't give in either and back down, especially if the cause is right. And as promised, I have on the line my good friend, and I probably would say one of the, if not the top expert on the subject of Agenda 21, the Mr. Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center. How are you doing, Tom?
Doing well, Hal. Good to be with you.
You know, I try to get you on the show, I don't know how many times, but every time, I'm flying here and I'm speaking there, and this is good because you're in transit a whole lot promoting this. You've pretty much covered the whole country speaking on this, and not only the whole country, but have you been invited to other countries as well?
I've been talking with and working with activists in other countries. There's an activist in Denmark who has made several videos, particularly featuring my books, and he's actually gotten copies of my books to the Prime Minister of Denmark and all of the mayors there in the country. I'm working with activists in Brazil. I'm working with a senator in Australia, and we're working on putting together a series of videos there. I may end up in Australia before too long. So.
That's
yeah.
good. That's good to know.
It's been crazy. This year I have done nothing but travel and speak and rally people and teach them how to fight back against these things.
Yeah, one of the things I notice, I have alerts on my online alerts, so when the term Agenda 21 shows up, I will be alerted. And sometimes it's December 21st, it is an agenda at the local library. Okay, but I noticed that around the world, when I get information from other parts of the world, they still use Agenda 21. They don't hide it. Here in the United States, thanks to people like you, that's a dirty term, and they don't like to use that term. So they've changed it. Even the term complete streets. In my community, which I mentioned earlier with Debbie on the line here, they call it street diets now. Oh, the street is having a diet. It's going to shrink from, instead of having a 40-inch waist, you're going to have a nice 32-inch waist, right? So instead of having four lanes.
These are clever guys. They're very creative.
I'm telling you.
It's really funny because as we began to really shine the bright spotlight on this, and activists began to hear us and go into city council meetings, county commissioner meetings, and start questioning what they were doing, and they were using the term Agenda 21 and so forth. And the American Planning Association, which is one of the worst culprits in putting this together, they panicked, and they put together a boot camp for their their planners to teach them what not to say and what to say in their planning, because if they say certain words, that makes the opposition see red. And I have made it my mission to every word that they come up with, to invent, to say these things, that we take that and spread it. So eventually they're going to have to do their presentations in sign language because they won't have any words left.
Well, that means we're having an impact. Obviously not enough of an impact, but we are definitely, there's a there's something called nextdoor.com, which I think is every community has this. And I signed up, and they're putting people, the left has these petitions, to do this or this street diet. So I said, I'm going to start a petition to ban John Henry's, owner of the Red Sox. He also owns the Boston Globe. And in Boston, we passed this stupid plastic bag ban, which is being all over the country. It's to conform to Agenda 21. But the Boston Globe delivers these flyers every week, unsolicited, in these handleless plastic bags. They're the evil cousins of the plastic bags with handles. So I started this petition. I said, let's ban John Henry's bags. Oh, man, the left has no sense of humor. The one lady wants to, she's going to report me for being inappropriate, that I'm mean and I'm this and that. Although, did you say I'm mean, that I'm assaulting people? I said, I haven't assaulted anybody. I haven't even said anything other than use the general term leftist and hypocrisy. And I said, go ahead, please, because I said, I called her an ideological bigot and an enemy of free speech. I said, but I'm not going to have you. I'm not going to report you for this. So I'm getting under their skin. And so, because they want, and that's what happens. They call your names, and then they want to ban you. We don't want to debate this. And what's interesting, I'm kind of proud, is that there are a lot of people that even in my section of Boston that I'm buying into this nonsense. But
it's easy to get under their skin because it's so thin. And of course, that's just their compassion coming out.
Their compassion,
and,
right? Their zeal.
And, we're just a hate monger.
Yeah, zeal, and they're passionate about what. And we're not passionate. We're crazy hate monger conspiracy theorists, right? But to discuss, there's this evil presence in most of America today. That's why we are one of the most racist countries in the history of mankind, because we have something. Well, we do have the 13-star flag, which was an earlier of this horrible racist culture, but something called now. If you have any young people listening, please put them out of the room, because I'm going to say something that might be offensive to people under a certain age. The single family home. So that's supposed to be racist. Now, I used to think that the American dream, regardless of your black, white, Hispanic, or whatever, is to be able to have your own home, have your own yard, your own half acre, or one, even a little postage stamp where you can put a few tomato plants. You've attained something. You have something that's yours. It's real estate. It's private property. But now this is supposed to be a sign of racism. Can you elaborate on this craziness?
Yeah, what is happening is all across the country, these things don't just happen by osmosis. It is directed, and it's coming from, I really believe it's coming from HUD grants.
Right.
But all of a sudden you're seeing this pop up everywhere that single-family homes are racist, or that we have a housing crisis and we don't have room for single-family homes anymore. The mayor of Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is the first place where this began to pop up, and he said that single-family home zoning was devised as a legal way to keep black Americans and other minorities from moving into certain neighborhoods, and it still functions as an effective barrier today, and that people are self-segregating to keep people out that they don't want to live in their neighborhood. This is where the racism comes in to this. And it started there. We've seen it pop up in Baltimore. We've seen it in Chicago and, of course, California. But now we have Portland, Oregon. Just the state of Oregon. Speaker of the Oregon House, Tina Kotek, drafted the legislation, and I don't know if it's been signed by the governor yet or not, but it's on her desk, and saying that they have a housing crisis in Oregon. Well, the reason they have a housing crisis in Oregon is because, 20 years ago, Portland became the poster child for what they called smart growth, Agenda 21, sustainable development, smart growth programming. And what they did with that was they put a line around the city, these urban growth boundaries, and they said no growth will take place outside of that line, because that's urban sprawl. That means people will be driving their cars, and we'll have to put in infrastructure and all these horrible things. And so we're all going to just have a good, happy love-in here in the middle of Portland inside this boundary. Well, the problem is, 20 years later, the population of Portland grew by 80%. Mm. But they've only been able to expand the urban growth boundary by 6%, and now they have a housing crisis, and there's no room to have a single-family home with a yard and so forth. Why, in that space, we could put 100 families in high growth. All this is, Hal, as you well know, this is a move to lock away the rural areas, get people off the rural lands, and have these stack and pack high rises in the city. And this is what we're seeing in cities all over the country. But what's happening here is, as the growth continues to grow, then the high rises can only go so high, and then you get into thin air and you can't breathe. So you have to only go so high. So what do we do then? We start making the apartments smaller and smaller. And I've seen it advocated that we'd only have 350 square feet per apartment per family is one of the goals.
Well, it's interesting. I used to live in the Hyde Park section of Boston. I live pretty close by in West Roxbury now. And there was a nice little Second Empire-style home in my old neighborhood. And about 2 years, it had been empty for a while. It was set up on a little bit of an elevation. And I knew the family that lived there. It was a fellow from Ireland. He was an old school Irishman. He had two sons and a daughter. He used to have a beautiful garden. He had about, I guess, about a fourth of an acre. I don't think it was much more than that. And anyway, the house sat empty for a while. Then it was torn down. And my last visit to my neighborhood, there are now four, I think, 8 or 10 unit townhouses on what used to be a single family home. And that's an example of this stack 'em and pack 'em. In Boston by the Fenway Park area, 10 or 15 years ago, it was mostly the maybe 4 or 5 story brownstones, which is noted for that area, the Boston pudding stone. And today it looks like Midtown Manhattan. You've got 25 story condo units with offices. It looks like downtown Manhattan. And as far as this racism is concerned, it's happening in the inner cities as well. A few years ago, there was an inner city pastor, Reverend Bruce Wall. He had a parking lot across the street in the Grove Hall section of Dorchester. And this parking lot used to be a three-family home and a storefront that had become a crack house. It was abandoned and torn down by the city. The lot was empty. Now, 25 years ago, you couldn't give this land away. Nobody wanted to build here, high crime area. Now, the city wanted to sell that lot for $5 million. They've got bike paths on this road. So there was a little outreach, save the parking lot. And the parking lot was simply unpaved. It was just gravel. And this pastor, which he should have bought the land if he had the hindsight, should have bought the land, or foresight, I should say. He probably got it for nothing. So the city maintained it. They'd come by, once every 6 months and do something, pick up a few pieces of trash or what have you. But now they want to turn this into stack 'em and pack 'em housing. So what will happen is that the people who live in this neighborhood that could afford their rent, now their rents will go up because the idea is to get people in the suburbs to move into Boston. And so you're going to have the reverse effect. You're going to have mostly upper middle class whites moving into this once poor neighborhood. And the property around this would also go up, meaning that the people who live there now can't afford it. So they'll have to move to places like Brockton, Massachusetts. And they'll still be coming in because this is where they're from. This is where their churches are. Maybe their places of business. So there'll be no net gain if you're trying to your carbon footprint. And the same thing in San Francisco, a lot of the neighborhoods that were once poor neighborhoods, they're now gentrified, which means wealthy white liberals are coming in, and they're moving to Oakland. So the poor blacks have to move to Oakland now, where they can afford the rent. So that's the racism right there.
Absolutely, what you're describing there. This is what's happening in every city in the community, in the country, where we've got these development boards and so forth, and you've got all these non-governmental organizations,
paid to players,
like, American Planning Association and others. They're all working behind the scenes. They've got maps of the town all around, and they're making plans for every section of the town, and they're looking at these lower income neighborhoods, and they're saying, we'll use eminent domain, we'll go in there, we'll tear all that down, we'll build exactly what you just described. Well, the thing is that in those neighborhoods, there are folks who own homes, there are folks who have small businesses, and when the bulldozers come in, all of that is gone. And as you described, they can't afford to live where they used to. And now, in many cases, the only choice they have is to go on, if their business has been destroyed, maybe they're going to go on to welfare programs.
Public housing.
And they're going to go into public housing.
That's right.
From that moment forward, their life choices are gone. They no longer have the ability to decide for themselves and prosper for themselves. Now they are under the thumb of the government. This is one of the things that is happening to it. The other thing is that the people who have worked hard and have built their homes in single-family neighborhoods, building equity, building a personal wealth, private property is one of the only real means for the average person in the country to build personal wealth. all of that is wiped out, and in all these stack and packs and these massive neighborhoods like this, you will not find any private property rights. They won't be there. I was in New York City last year, and I was in a hotel, big meeting room there, and the windows looked out over Manhattan. And I was pitching to a radio host there to be on his show, and I was trying to talk to him about private property, and I saw the puzzled look on his face, and I said, turn around and look out that window. And as far as you could see out the window were all these stack and pack skyscrapers of New York, and I said, as far as your eye can see, there is not a single private property. There are people in the back rooms that are making all the decisions, and all you can do with your property is pay the rent and pay the taxes.
That's right.
He turned around and looked at me and said, we got to get you on.
That's right. And, you know, private property is one of the most important things that we have. And that's not just necessarily real estate, but it could be, intellectual property, too. It's yours. It's something you have. And, you know, when people ask me, you know, give me Agenda 21 in a nutshell, is it the first plank of the Communist Manifesto? Abolition of all private property. Is it the first or second? I think it's the first. That's the goal, is to do away with all private property.
Or, absolutely. You know, if you have private property, you're too independent. You're not dependent on the government. And that gets in their way. And our founding fathers understood this. That was why private property was essential to our founding fathers. And that's why the United States built an economy so quickly. But, one of the things that economists use to determine the health of our economy is housing starts.
That's right.
And
that's
all
right.
Of a sudden you're seeing them panicking, saying housing starts are down. Well, of course they are. We're wiping out the ability to build housing.
That's right.
And this will affect our economy. As we eliminate private property, we will begin to see the wealth of our nation go down in an exact same proportion, to the point where and here's the other thing that goes with this. As they're building these stack and packs and all these apartments, you have landlords, people who own those buildings. They are raising the taxes and raising the cost of the building products and so forth to build these things, and then the landlords raise the rent to meet their expenses, and they're saying, oh, that's not fair. That's racist too. So we're going to put rent controls on so that the people can have a fair rent for it. You shouldn't get rich off of this. What you're going to see is landlords are going to go out of business. Eventually, the bottom line to all of this, elimination of single-family homes, elimination of private landlords, all housing is going to be government housing.
And, you know, it's interesting. In the 60s, before they had Agenda 21, they had urban renewal, and they would focus in poor neighborhoods where there were single-family homes, and they would tear them all down and put these folks in beautiful government housing where there's crime and drugs and, you know, filthy, dirty conditions. And, you know, living in Boston, there's a certain housing project. There's a house. It's no longer there. Now it's all rich, wealthy area. But it was a project where even the police, the fire department would not go without police escort. You know, that's how bad it was. And that was the fate. Oh, we're helping people by putting me in these government housing projects.
Well, look at the scenes we've just seen from Baltimore of these horrendous places that people are living in, and I'm sure you've seen the videos that I've seen
the
of the
rats.
People who went up there to help clean it out,
yep.
And so forth, and took out, what was it, 30 tons of trash or something like that, some outrageous amount, and this is what we are condemning these people to, and all telling us the government's going to help, and this is what it boils down to, and here they are, dividing up our communities, making all these plans, setting us all under this thumb. And, you know, I want to see everybody prosper. I want to see everybody have an equal opportunity to build a life of their own. But because we oppose that kind of a destiny for everyone, that we're the racists and they're the ones with the compassion, I say that that's a little bit upside down.
Tom, we got about 5 minutes left, and I'm holding up a copy of your novel, Erase. So could you talk a little bit about this and some of the other writings that you have done, books you've published?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Erase, I wrote a couple years ago, And it's the first time I ever wrote fiction. I didn't think I was capable of it. And this story just started coming. What it really is talking about is erasing our history, erasing our past. And I have five different characters in it that are coming at this from five different directions. One's a teacher, one is a publisher of books, and one is a political activist, and one is a pastor. And one is what we dub in the book graffiti bandit, who puts these mysterious messages on the side of government buildings and gets them all a little worried. And there's supposed to be a special report that reveals who is behind the control that's destroying the economy and making government bigger, and, you know, the same thing we're dealing with today, the deep state you talk about. But every time somebody finds this report, they die, and that's the mystery of the book. But it is all set in the sustainable world we're talking about here, and how people are forced to live, and how they are changing our history, and how they're eliminating our past with it all. What shocks me about it is, having never written fiction before, the reviews started to come in. I've got six or eight reviews that have all compared the book to 1984, Atlas Shrugged, Michael Crichton's State of Fear.
Really?
I fell on the floor the first time I saw one of those, because it just shocked me, because I didn't know what I had. But I have gotten nothing but positive reports from people. And I think the best review I've ever gotten was from a lady who said, I have about 26 pages left to read, and I don't want to finish it because I don't want it to end.
That's high praise indeed. And like a lot of these novels based on, you know, Taylor Caldwell was, I'm not a big novel guy, but Taylor Caldwell wrote novels that were just great. And it was always, it's a history lesson there too. And what would happen if we don't keep our freedoms? Now you've also written Tell Me I Was Wrong or something.
Now, Tell Me I Was Wrong was a collection of articles I wrote over about a 15-year period on these issues we're talking about. Also covers personal privacy and the education system, how our education system got to be what it is today. Wrote all that, and Now Tell Me I Was Wrong was the title, because I had been derided for writing those articles, and people said, no, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's all come to pass, so I used that title. My latest book is called Sustainable, The War on Free Enterprise, Private Property, and Individuals, and I wrote it as a handbook. This isn't fiction. This is, I wish it was, but it's a policy book, and it I wrote it as a handbook for activists to have all the background, what these policies are, where they came from, who's behind them, and then at the end we go into ways to fight back.
And you are available through the American Policy Center is your website?
Yeah, our website, American Policy Center, our website is americanpolicy.org. And on there, we get all the books there, but we also have an archive of lots and lots of articles we've written over the years on all these issues. And we have really been working to create tools to help activists, to help people on the local level fight back against these things. And you'll find them there.
So I've been on the site a number of times. It's a lot of good. There's a lot of good resources there. And sometimes you have a question of what's this going on in my town? You put the there's a little internal search there. The article will come up or video will come up, and pretty much you're not copywriting these articles. You want the stuff out there. You're not rationing the bullets, are you?
Oh, absolutely. Anybody who asks me if they can reprint it or ever anything like that, absolutely. That's the point of it. Get it out there and spread it far and wide.
And put it on the when you go to your town hall, put it in the right on the desks of your mayors and your city councilors, and then organize. And we were talking about earlier with Debbie Bacigalupi, our plan to have a Agenda 21 challenge and getting young people to fight Agenda 21 to be an answer to the Greta Thunbergs of the world.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I saw the video on it, and that is a fantastic idea. Like she says, everywhere we go and we speak, people will point out all the gray heads in the room.
Gray heads or bald ones too, right?
And so getting them involved is absolutely essential. And I will say, I am seeing more and more young people get involved in the fight. Organization that I came through clear back in the 60s that got me involved in all this, Young Americans for Freedom, has been reorganized and is building new chapters on campuses.
That's great.
And there are others like that as well. So I'm encouraged, and I'm hearing some good things about some young people. We only hear the snowflakes at the demonstrations, but these good young people are there, and they understand the problem, and they are working to fight back.
Well, Tom, thank you so much. I'm heading down to Virginia, actually, this weekend, but I'm going to be speaking down in Falls Church. I hope I'll catch you back in the middle of late September, I think. So hopefully we'll connect then.
All right. I'm heading to Spokane, Washington, tomorrow.
Excellent.
So.
All right, Tom.
Be there.
Okay. God bless.